Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to another episode of EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. And by the way, we are in the first podcast of 2025, so all the best to all of you for this very new year. My name is Thomas Berger. I'm chair of the Department of Neurology at the Medical University in Vienna, Austria. And I was the past chair of the scientific committee. And now it's my really big pleasure and honor to welcome my chat partner, Professor Gerion Fink, who is chair of the department, neurological department, at the Medical University in Cologne, and he is the present chair of the Scientific Committee of EAN. Welcome to our podcast and chat. I think we have a very, 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 very nice topic for a good start in 2025, because usually we look back a little bit. In this podcast, we look back to the years or even decades of developments in neurology, and the podcast today is called From Then to Now, Neurology Through the Years. We thought that we will talk a bit in detail about our feeling views of the developments in neurology over the past decades and a little bit about our favorite showcases. So, Gerion, do you have a favorite development in neurology over the past decades?
Yes, Thomas. Thank you for asking. I have indeed a couple of favorites that nicely demonstrate that a better understanding of the pathophysiology is the key to the development of specific therapies. And I choose now an example from a field in which you work more in than I do, and that's the field of multiple sclerosis. When you and I started in neurology, I mean, let's tell people the truth, we had cortisone and azathioprine to treat patients with multiple sclerosis. And that is due to the fact that it was appreciated that there was some sort of apparent immunological response causing multiple sclerosis, but there was no specific knowledge about the actual processes underlying multiple sclerosis. One of the first real breakthroughs in the therapy, of course, was that interferon beta was approved by the FDA for the treatment of relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis in 1993. And that was a real game changer, as you know, with clatiramer acetate following soon. And for the first time, these injectables really allowed us to modulate the immune system. And of course, subsequently, there were other really important steps, like the first development of a monoclonal antibody in 2004 with atezolizumab, and then, of course, subsequently, the finding that, for example, there were side effects of such stronger impacts on the immune system with the development of progressive multiple leukoencephalopathy, etc., as you know it, with subsequent development of oral therapies. So it's a tremendous example of the changes that have been brought into the field of neurology by an understanding of the pathophysiology and the pathomechanisms. And it shows nicely that neuroscience is important, basic neuroscience that informs clinical neuroscience for the development of novel therapies.
So you mentioned the keyword, it's not MS, of course, but the keyword neuroscience. So pathophysiology, the understanding, the knowledge gain, but also the translational aspect is, of course, not a gut feeling. It's not a out of the blue, it's based on science. So what was the trigger for this scientific dramatic developments in neurology, specifically in neurology? Was it the methods? Was it the gaining interest in the community? So what is your feeling that neurology so dramatically evolved over the past years?
I think there are several key factors. One is that, as you mentioned, indeed, there have been tremendous methodological advances in basic neuroscience. For example, let's talk about the understanding of what B cells are for, what T cells are for, and how you can investigate their specific changes over time, which then informed people working in the field of multiple sclerosis. The development of antibodies based on the knowledge of, for example, receptor mechanisms and changes induced in cells. If you look at the field of myasthenia gravis, I mean, the tremendous changes we have faced there. So a lot of methodological developments till to date, if you think about proteomics and what we gain, what insights we gain from proteomics, just to name one example. Another key methodological advancement, of course, was imaging. I mean, when we started in neurology, we had CT and we had MRI, but at what sort of resolution? And they were not even universally available. They were available in university hospitals. So we have learned about the development of lesions, even in the novel therapies and therapeutic monitoring. And you have just recently been involved in a study yourself that is probably changing how we are going to treat patients with multiple sclerosis by just looking at changes of the lesions in the MRI. So another key advance in the field of neurology due to functional and structural imaging that has been developed. And you could name other examples, the insights that have been made available by electrophysiology. Think about the development of deep brain stimulation in treating first tremor and then subsequently also Parkinson's disease. So there are fantastic examples of methodological advances that informed basic neuroscientists, which then informed clinical neuroscientists and allowed us to, at the end of the day, perform clinical trials demonstrating that understanding the pathophysiology and the pathomechanisms is fundamental to the development of novel therapies.
Yeah, I think doubtless to say, following your words and explanations, neurology turned from a more descriptive speciality to a more diagnostic and most importantly also treating speciality. And I think that's also the success story in the field of neurology. However, I think it's not only the, let's say it in a kind of flapsy way, probably not only the mere understanding of the science, but also probably because neurologists got more brave in therapeutic uses. You mentioned, for example, deep brain stimulation, but it's the same also with the first showcase or role model you explained, MS, the first use of a monoclonal antibody in neurology. So as the elderly neurologists we are already, or the more matured, we have not been confronted with those therapies, also those therapies which might cause a certain risk. So did we grow more brave?
That's a very interesting question. I think you're probably right. More daring than neurologists probably were in the past. I remember very well the introduction of deep brain stimulation, which, as I say, was initially developed by the Frenchman Benabi and his neurology colleague, Pierre Pollack, who introduced this in 1993, also for the subthalamic nucleus stimulation to treat rigidity and akinesia and Parkinson. And I remember the first time I came across deep brain stimulation in 1997 when I returned from the UK to Düsseldorf at that time, which was the first center in Germany to pick up deep brain stimulation together with the Department of Stereotaxy in Cologne. And I mean, we withdrew patients from their anti-Parkinsonian medication post-operatively. And what happened is, of course, what we nowadays know is the DOPA withdrawal syndrome. And we just had to learn how to do this properly. But it was possible to do these things because due to the understanding of the pathophysiology, we knew at that time that indeed patients would benefit from these type of interventions. And of course, this was a learning experience. And as you say, the people who did it at that time, they were brave and probably daring quite a bit. But it was obvious that the patients in the long run benefited from it. And the more these patients were treated, the more there was the understanding of how to do it, how to withdraw the medication carefully over time. And nowadays, it's a well-established therapy. So yes, probably people were braver than they were 20 or 30 years ago.
Which is probably also a matter of being a pioneer. You need a certain, let's say, interest or also kind of dedication or daring, as you said, pioneer a new method or a new therapy. Now, the example you said with deep brain stimulation is, of course, let's say, I don't want to say limited, but of course, done by tertiary or expertise specialized centers. Now, if we look to the developments, and I think we can also share our experiences 30 years ago, how to treat stroke, for example. So it was a lot of fluid application, but no specific therapy. And now we have a huge pathway pre-hospital, in the hospital, stroke units, interventional therapies. So this is, I think, a dramatic also development in a very broad care management in the population, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's another very nice example also of the power of neurology. If you work in an interdisciplinary environment and if you work in centers that collaborate with each other. As you know, the initial breakthrough was in 2008, the lysis therapy. I mean, as you mentioned before that, we had hemodilution, and that was basically how we treated patients suffering from a stroke. And then in 2008, lysis therapy was developed. And then the real revolution, of course, was in 2015 after the publication of several landmark papers going for thrombectomy. And we all know these studies, Mr. Clean, Rivascate, Escape, etc., that were also then pooled in a meta-analysis in Hermes, showing very nicely that across countries, pooling the data, you can provide definitive results with a significant increase in the proportion of patients who were alive and who were independent at 3 months. And the fantastic number needed to treat ranged in these studies between 3 and 7. I mean, what intervention in medicine do you know about that has a number needed to treat between 3 and 7? Just to give you two examples. One is you need to treat 160 people with statins to reduce one stroke. And you need to treat 100 people for carotid artery stenosis with an operation, so with vascular surgery, to prevent one stroke. And with thrombectomy, a number needed to treat is between 3 and 7, depending on which studies you look at. So as you say, a dramatic change that has become available and which also shows very nicely at the same time that there's still a way to go. Because as you know, to date, depending on how far you want to shift the borders, 10-15% of the patients can really benefit from thrombectomy. But even in well-developed countries in Europe, less than 3% of the stroke patients are currently treated, even in some of the well-developed countries, not to talk about countries where there's not as good development in the healthcare system.
Now, EAN always uses the nice allegory of the House of Neurology. If we then translate into the developments and also the scientific merits which appeared over the past decades, I think it's not only a house, it's a skyscraper in the meanwhile. But where do we want to come to? So we are not at the end of the road. Probably we are in the very first beginning, in the first third. How can we, from the sky scratcher, touch the clouds and get more a place to the sun? What is the next steps, or what do you foresee on developments in a kind of, let's say, midterm time frame?
That's a tricky question, because we all know that current development is at such a speed that it's difficult to forecast what specific breakthrough is coming next, what specific method is going to help us most. You said a few minutes ago that when we went into neurology, neurology was about diagnosing. And that has changed dramatically. Neurology is about now treating patients. So it's an exciting time to be a neurologist if you want to treat patients. But I think it's an even more exciting time if you are a young neurologist, because of the developments that neurology will face. It will get personalized. There's no question about that. So I'm pretty sure that a better understanding of why one subject benefits from a therapy and another subject benefits less from a therapy will be a fundamental way of personalizing medicine. And here, of course, we're talking about genetics. So there will be a huge influence of the individual genome, knowing about the individual subject and what's the best way of treating patients. Another field that I personally find exciting is, of course, prevention. Because at the end of the day, we don't just want to repair things, but of course, ideally, we will be able to prevent neurological diseases. So another exciting field to look at, of course, is the changes in the environment. And I'm not just talking about climate. This includes climate changes, but changes in the environment, a better understanding of the impact of climate changes, environmental changes, will be instrumental in developing deeper insights into how neurological diseases develop and how these can be prevented. So exciting times, but it's very difficult to forecast what specific method is going to be the forerunner in the front of scratching the sky, as you said it.
Now, of course, I think, again, in a very, I think, trivial expression, but I think my personal feeling is neurology is really a sexy specialty, a lot of activities. And I think, as you said, it's not only that old chaps are talking about the past and the current situation. I think it's for the younger generation. It's a really highly interesting field, because it also had a mind change from a, as we already mentioned several times, from a kind of therapeutic nihilistic view in chronic diseased neurological patients to a era where we probably not only fix the diagnosis much earlier, but also can treat more efficiently and move into prevention. So I know that you said it's a broad field, but do you have a personal feeling where prevention will be the most likely gain also in society by focusing more on prevention and prevention research?
Yeah, I mean, probably, of course, cardiovascular diseases, including, of course, as we all know, cerebrovascular diseases, will be absolutely essential. If you run through the risk factors for dementia, then we know that about 40% at least can be identified and treated. And that's tremendous. I mean, we are on the verge of another dramatic change in neurology, disease-modifying therapies in Alzheimer's disease. They're not perfect yet, and we know it's multifactorial, but it's getting more and more specific based on the knowledge of the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease. But at present, even if we can treat these diseases more specifically, because they are multifactorial, we should definitely go for the prevention part of it. And at least 40% of the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease is preventable by looking at identified factors. So certainly we should do that. As I said, cerebrovascular disease, cardiovascular disease is one of the key issues to that, but there are many others like early hearing loss, etc., air pollution, sufficient sleep is another big issue in that. So despite the fact that we are really facing entirely new story about treating patients with Alzheimer's disease, given the verge of disease-modifying therapies, we should not forget about prevention.
Probably we could also touch a bit of a other field in neuroscience, because we were talking a lot about clarifying or getting better insights in pathomechanisms, pathophysiology, treatment targets, treatment developments. But isn't there still also room for understanding our brain, our nervous system, and that, for example, also with methods which we have now and we can use to better understand, you know, for example, connectomics or the disruption of connectomics or the understanding of behavior, of function. So this is also still, I don't want to say black box, but still a lot of questions still remain to be solved, isn't it?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. I mean, as you know, I'm a cognitive neurologist by training. That, of course, is close to my personal scientific heartbeat. I agree with you. We have methods at hand, which we probably need to develop further. You talked about connectomics. Connectomics, of course, is not just about a structural sense. We have fantastic imaging facilities at hand that allow us to look at structural connectomics, but connectomics is also about functional connections in the brain. And although we know that a lot talk in the brain between neurons is about synchronization, nevertheless, we have a poor understanding of the exact processes that enable motor functions, that enable cognition, that enable memory, that enable feeling. So yes, we have this vague knowledge that neurons need to crosstalk with each other, that they need to synchronize, that it's about phase and amplitude, but the specifics of all these things are still elusive. So there's great work that needs to be done in that field, which mirrors the great work that needs to be done with regard to treating patients. And I think I've said it before, if I wasn't in the field of neuroscience, this would be the moment to go into the field of neuroscience and neurology.
So this means our expectation is the field of neurosciences is so broad, so interesting, that there is a lot of room not only to explore, to understand still a lot of functions, mechanisms, treatments, pathophysiology. Now, knowing this and also, of course, expecting this and pathing the ground for, as you said, the next generation or the current generation, we are also faced with some interesting, let's say, behavior in terms of scientific skepticism in the broad public, or even hostility. So, you know, on the one hand, we have this demand, of course, as neurologists, but I think it's in many other fields. And on the other side, there is a kind of hesitancy to consider this important. Do you have an explanation, especially in our countries, Austria, Germany, this skepticism about science and scientific efforts is, I think, unnecessary high. So how can we avoid this? How can we increase the awareness in another way?
Yeah, that's they're raising another very interesting issue, Thomas. At least in Germany, I think a big mistake by scientists in the last couple of years was in the corona crisis, that they sort of did not transmit the important key message that science is never absolute. It's all about current knowledge and what we know at present, and that these things can change in the future. So at least in Germany, some of the people working in the field of science sort of helped the government in the sense of that statements were made in a fairly apodictic way, which were then used by the government to insert the rules that had to be followed during the corona crisis. And it hasn't helped science. So one of the things that scientists should always be aware of themselves, but also allow to say that in public, that this is current knowledge. And tomorrow this may change because we will come up with new evidence. Another issue is the crisis of replicability. And even as scientists, of course, this is worrisome that there are many studies that never get replicated. And we need to discuss this. We need to come up with procedures that control for this effect, that we sort of come up with reliable evidence that can be replicated. So there are different aspects that fuel the skepticism about science in general. And we as scientists, I think, are called up to try and be open about that so that we gain the confidence that we are not talking about absolute knowledge, but that we are really talking about current evidence that, of course, tomorrow by different methods, new evidence, etc., of course, can be overturned and which needs to be reconsidered critically.
Yes, I think we could talk about this topic quite some hours. And by the way, I also fear that definitely, but slowly, but definitely, we're coming to the end of our podcast, despite we could also talk about the success story so far in neurology and all the interesting aspects for the next several days without any problems, I guess. I would like to ask you a last question because, of course, we are in the EAN Weekly Neurology podcast. As chair of the EAN Scientific Committee, what can the Scientific Committee or EAN contribute to this further scientific development, achievements in the understanding or also preventing neurological disorders?
Yeah, as you know, we've discussed that on the board a couple of times, and there's no easy answer to that. One is, of course, about education. The other one is about promoting science. So it's really trying to draw in both people from basic neuroscience and clinicians and make them work together, trying to facilitate clinical research, translational research, and empower the next generation of clinician scientists. And there's not going to be quick progress. It's always, science is always slow. It's step by step. The breakthroughs happen, but they happen rarely. It's incremental evidence that needs to be collected. And this also, of course, nowadays really means collaborating interdisciplinarily across countries. And this, I think, is what the EAN can do: educate people, empower people, bring them together, and transmit the fun of doing neuroscience and doing neurology and make that infectious so that we can continue to excel in these areas.
Garen, that was the perfect summary and closing. I would like to thank you so much for this very interesting chat we had, and also for, I think it's stimulants enough to continue this or potentially continue for the next couple of days. I hope to the auditorium that it was interesting for you. And once again, I would like to wish you all the best for 2025, and specifically keep your interest and enthusiasm. There will be ongoing interesting things happening in the field of neurosciences and neurology. Thank you very much, and see you next week.
Thank you, Thomas.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.